Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Day three today for the president's legal team to argue his defense against impeachment. Last night, especially in prime time, the president's lawyers argued that whatever he did, none of it was wrong. Here's Alan Dershowitz.
Do abuse of power and obstruction of Congress constitute impeachable offenses? The relevant history answers that question clearly in the negative.
Well, last week, as the House managers laid out their case, we talked to two constitutional scholars about how they're watching the impeachment trial, what they're looking for, how they're judging the arguments. So today, we'll do the same analysis of the president's defense. This hour on Point, examining the public efficacy and the legal merits of the president's case. And you can join us. What stands out for you in what you're hearing from the White House legal team? What do you need help understanding about what's happening in the Senate chamber this week? Well, we are going to hear from a couple legal scholars today, but let's begin with Jonathan Turley. He is a legal scholar and law professor at George Washington University. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee on December 4th for Republicans in the impeachment proceedings in the House against President Trump. Professor Turley, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, tell us, what are your first impressions of what you've heard from the White House, or the president's, I should say, legal team over the weekend and yesterday in their defense of President Trump?
Well, they've done a fine job in a number of respects. I thought that Alan Dershowitz did an outstanding job last night. I think that the most success they've had is demolishing Article 2, which is the obstruction of Congress article. I was highly critical of that article in my testimony to the House, but I thought that the team did particularly well in showing why that article is pretty much dead as Dillinger. I'm still surprised that they went forward with it.
Why? So tell us more about why, from a legal perspective, you think that.
Well, as I said, when I testified in the House, I opposed four articles of impeachment, including bribery, extortion. Those four ultimately were rejected by the committee, and I said there were two legitimate articles. One is abuse of power, and one is obstruction of Congress. But the record was incomplete, that they could not submit this record in good faith to the Senate, particularly on Article 2. And the reason is, this is the shortest impeachment investigation of a president in history. And what they were saying is that you have to turn over this material during this abbreviated period. And if you don't, you're going to court. You're challenging our authority is itself a high crime and misdemeanor. And in my view, that was itself quite abusive. And to make matters worse, they had arguments to make, that is the White House. I think that they really laid out nicely how these subpoenas were issued without the traditional vote, giving the authority for the subpoenas. That's not a frivolous argument. That's one of the many missing elements that existed in this, what I've referred to as a slipshod investigation. This was not done the way earlier investigations were done. And the White House had legitimate challenges to make. And what concerned me most is that if you start to say that a president who challenges Congress's authority in court is an impeachable offense, and virtually any president in our lifetime could have been impeached. And what's important to note is that both Clinton and Nixon were able to go all the way to the Supreme Court to challenge Congress's or the independent counsel's right to evidence. And after the Supreme Court ruled, Nixon resigned, and ultimately Clinton was impeached.
So, but isn't there a difference, though, between an independent counsel and Congress?
I actually think whatever difference there is works against Congress in this respect. The objections being made by the White House were not frivolous. I raised this issue back in January, why the House Judiciary didn't simply get a vote authorizing the impeachment inquiry. And I encouraged them to take people like Don McGahn to court, which they ultimately did and won. But they never got that vote. They never got the base authority that I encouraged them to get. And that came back to really haunt them. This was very improvisational for an impeachment. It's like Nancy Pelosi going to a press conference and simply announcing, we're now in an impeachment inquiry, as if the Speaker of the House has that authority.
Hmm. So tell me then, I mean, if you were, we did this last week when we spoke to a couple legal scholars about the House manager's case. I asked them to sort of put themselves in the shoes of the president's defense and how they would argue against what they had been hearing from the House managers. I'll ask you the same thing now, Professor Turley. Like, if you had been Adam Schiff last week, what is the argument that you would have made that would have counterbalanced or counteracted the defense you're hearing from President Trump's team this week?
Well, I think that they did make the best argument with regard to Article 1. I disagree with my friend Alan Dershowitz. We always have on this issue. Not always. He actually changed his view from the Clinton trial. But I've disagreed with him on the fact that impeachable offenses require crimes. I don't believe that that is true. I testified in the Clinton impeachment and the Trump impeachment and dealt with that theory in both of those impeachment hearings. I just don't believe it's sustainable, and I thought that Adam Schiff did a very good job. I think Schiff did well overall. He was my opposing counsel in the last impeachment. I represented the judge in the last impeachment, and I thought very highly of his abilities, and I think that you saw that with the House managers. I think the White House made a mistake to craft so much of their defense around this controversial theory of Professor Dershowitz.
Well, Professor Turley, hang on here for just a moment because I'd like to bring in another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Kate Shaw. She's with us from New York. She's a law professor at Cardozo Law at Yeshiva University. She worked in the White House Counsel's Office as a special assistant to the president and associate counsel to President Barack Obama. She also clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens at the U.S. Supreme Court. So, Professor Shaw, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you heard what Professor Turley just said about that he sees the president's legal team as having demolished that obstruction of Congress charge. Do you agree? Disagree? What do you think?
I do disagree. You know, I think that Jonathan is right that there may have been legal arguments that the White House had to offer in the context of the House proceedings. But I think that what the White House was doing in terms of the blanket resistance to the enterprise of requesting documents and requesting testimony wasn't consistent with past practice. It is true that both Nixon and Clinton resisted to some degree efforts by both independent counsels and Congress to turn over documents. But I'm not sure we have any example in our history of a White House so thoroughly refusing to engage in the process of negotiation and accommodation as the Trump White House did. And so I think it was a defensible choice for the House to simply say, we're getting nothing. So you have essentially withdrawn from the constitutional process of, you know, a back and forth about what kind of entitlement we have to information. And so rather than trying to fight you on the margins, we're going to draft an article of impeachment around this conduct. Now, I do think that there may have been some tactical error in not pursuing the John Bolton testimony in court and at the same time moving forward with the impeachment. But I don't think that the conduct of the White House here is as consistent with previous presidents' conduct as Jonathan suggests.
But tell us more about that, though, because as Professor Turley said, the hurried nature, what felt like the hurried nature of the decision making in the House, he sees as part of the problem. I mean, as you just said, If the House had waited for legal proceedings around testimony from Bolton et al., would that have cleared up that issue?
You know, so Schiff has always taken the position that, you know, it took the Congress, you know, I guess it was a Judiciary Committee subpoena, 8 months to get even a district court ruling in the Don McGahn case. And I think they looked at the pace of those proceedings and made the, I think, defensible judgment that they just weren't confident that they'd be able to get any definitive resolution, you know, in, especially from the Supreme Court, right, the kind of highest resolution of this case, fast enough to actually, you know, do the responsible thing, which is not to have an impeachment right on the eve of a presidential election. I actually think it was something that, you know, involved some consideration of the national interest in having this resolved one way or another, you know, before August or September or October of an election year. And then to the extent the president's team can saying, you know, they're interfering with an election, that those arguments have much more heft if it's actually the eve of an election. So I think that that was part of it. Now, I think that it is right that expedited resolution of particular claims in the courts is a possibility. So there, you know, I think an open question whether they might have been able to really press hard. Occasionally, federal courts, when they're doing things like resolving disputes around elections, right, where there's a deadline and they mm-hmm. absolutely have to move fast. And of course, you know, in the Nixon tapes case, the litigation proceeded very quickly in the district court. They skipped the intermediate appellate court, and it was 3 weeks between the oral argument and the decision that President Nixon was required to turn over the tapes. So it can happen, and so maybe it would have been wise to proceed that way. But I also think it was a little bit of an assertion of congressional supremacy that these House managers were involved with to say, you know, we don't need to run to the courts to vindicate our right to these kinds of materials. Like, we ourselves as a co-equal branch of government can make these demands, and those are as legally binding as a judicial ruling. Now, of course, courts in our system have the last word, but it's kind of a, you know, an assertion of the primacy, or at least that equality of that branch, that I think implicitly Congress, or, you know, the House managers are making here.
Yeah. So, Professor Turley, let me get your response to that, because that is at heart sort of one of the core constitutional questions here. Like, should Congress not assert its co-equal nature to the executive?
Oh, I'm a great fan of Congress asserting its authority. I've testified a dozen times begging them to push back on executive privilege and executive immunities. But in this case, I think this history will show that this was a historic blunder on the part of the House leadership. There is expedition that occurs with impeachment. When Adam Schiff said it took eight months to get the John McGahn, even without an impeachment imprimatur, he was wrong. That's not true. It took 4 months. The actual issue was put in front of the court. The court, without the expedition of an impeachment, took 4 months. And it would move much, much faster. But the idea of we have to get this resolved is not much of an answer if you're going to bring something dead on arrival. And that's what they did when they handed their case over to the opposing party in the other house.
Well, Professor Jonathan Turley and Professor Kate Shaw, stand by. We are bringing some analysis to the president's defense as it's being laid out this week in the Senate chamber. And we want to know what your question is. What help do you need understanding what's happening in the Senate today? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the president's defense in the impeachment trial currently going on in the United States Senate. And we're doing an legal analysis of the defense that's being offered by the president's lawyers. It's the mirror image of what we did last week when the House managers presented their case. And in order to help us today, I'm joined by Professor Kate Shaw. She's a law professor at Cardozo Law at Yeshiva University. She worked in the White House counsel's office as a special assistant to the president and associate counsel to President Obama. Professor Jonathan Turley also joins us as well. He is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University and testified as a witness in the House impeachment proceedings against President Trump back in December. And I want to play for both of you a moment from the president's defense. So here is White House counsel Pat Cipollone talking about how he sees Democrats, or arguing that Democrats have not come close to meeting the burden of proof required in an impeachment case like this. And he went on to say that the impeachment process itself, in his view, and obviously in the president's view as well, was essentially election interference.
And the fact that they came here for 24 hours and hid evidence from you is further evidence that they don't really believe in the facts of their case. That this is, for all their talk about election interference, that they're here to perpetrate the most massive interference in an election in American history. And we can't allow that to happen.
White House Counsel Pat Cipollone. Kate Shaw, I have two questions about what you just heard there. First of all, when Cipollone says hid evidence from you, that the House managers hid evidence from the senators, what is he referring to?
You know, I'm not sure what came right before that clip. I imagine that there were a few accusations that there were sort of selective excerpts from some of the witness testimony that the House managers played during their 3 days of argument. And so I think at a few points, the president's defenders argued that the choices made about what clips to play concealed the context or what came before. So perhaps that's what he was suggesting there, or potentially, you know, additional details regarding, you know, well-founded sort of concerns about corruption and Burisma. There are a few different places where I think the president's team believed that the House managers were shading the facts. But of course, in a legal proceeding or even a quasi-legal proceeding, which is what this is, each side emphasizes the facts that they believe to be favorable to their ultimate case. And so I'm not sure that he really landed any punches with any of that. I mean, on his first kind of the beginning of his case, actually on the first day in the Senate, Cipollone, I think, was sort of criticized across the aisle for having incorrectly suggested that in the House proceedings that Schiff's Republican colleagues were denied access to the SCIF, right, this secure facility in which the initial depositions were taking place. So he was obviously subject to accusations of misleading or potentially incorrect statements himself on the Senate floor. So those accusations, I think, have been coming from both sides.
So a little follow-up on that then, though, because it's not necessarily the same thing when in the course of a legal proceeding that counsel decides to focus on one set of facts versus another. That is not the same thing as in beforehand during the impeachment inquiry of the White House is simply not allowing or not offering or allowing people to testify or offering documents. I mean, for those of us outside the legal world, how are we supposed to understand these two behaviors?
Well, I mean, I think to the point I was making earlier, I think that the White House's total refusal to participate in the proceedings, that the defense ends up mounted sort of such as it is by the Republicans on both the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committee, but the president's team was absent and then have made repeated allegations in the Senate trial that they were excluded from the process. And that, I think, is one of the most serious mischaracterizations of the record, that somehow they were prevented from any participation. And, you know, it is true that under the House rules, agency counsel was denied presence at a particular early stage of the proceedings. But the president's counsel was very much entitled to participate and opted not to, I think, because they preferred to mount their case in what they understood to be a more favorable venue, which is, of course, a Republican-controlled Senate. Mm-hmm. So that I think is a quite unfair characterization of the House proceedings.
Right. So one more question, and Professor Turley, I'll then turn back to you. But the last thing that Cipollone said in that little bite there, where he asserts that the impeachment is, quote unquote, the most massive interference in an election in American history, end quote, doesn't that get to what we were all discussing a little earlier, that both the president's defense team and the president's supporter would see any impeachment before November 2020 as extremely political, extremely partisan? And what was the harm? What was the harm in waiting until after the election?
Right. Well, a couple of answers to that. One, I think that any Well, okay, so most impeachments, by definition, if successful in the ultimate sense, right, if they result in removal, in some way undo a Democratic decision. Now, that's, of course, that's not quite true about Andrew Johnson, the first presidential impeachment, because mm-hmm. he was never elected president. He was the vice president and then ascended to the presidency. But any time you pursue impeachment against a president, if it is ultimately successful, that undoes a Democratic process. But impeachment is a constitutional process. It is pursued and then decided by constitutionally selected and democratically accountable officials, both in the House and in the Senate. And then the last thing I'll say is that if it is successful in the sense of resulting in conviction and removal from office, what happens? The president's hand-picked number two ascends to the presidency. So it just feels like a real whole, you know, the Cipollone rhetoric and a lot of the rhetoric from, I think, the president's team throughout have sort of created the impression that if 67 senators vote to convict President Trump, then Nancy Pelosi becomes the president, right? Or Adam Schiff becomes the president. And that's not at all how it works. The president is number two. The vice president of the United States, Mike Pence, would become the president. And that is also consistent with, you know, the, you know, expressed preferences of the 63 million Americans that the president's team continually invokes. So it feels to me like it's, you know, it's scrambling a little bit the sort of the political meaning of this process to suggest that it is fundamentally undemocratic or election interference. Mm.
Jonathan Turley, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that the issue was between pushing this to the Senate at a record pace or waiting till after the election. What I strongly and repeatedly encourage the House Judiciary to do is to wait a couple of months in order to get some of these witnesses, get favorable court orders. All of that could have been done. That's why this is such a baffling blunder on the part of the House leadership. They were obsessed with impeaching the president before Christmas, which is an arbitrary decision that they made, and it cost them dearly because the minute they voted, effectively the record was closed. When they hand this case over to the other body, they're in a position, as they are now, of begging not just the other House but the opposing party to complete their case. It was really incredibly moronic, and I couldn't believe that they were actually doing it. I mean, the idea that we really have to rush to get an incomplete and effectively dead case to the Senate is rather bizarre. But then they destroyed their own narrative by stopping on a dime after they did it and waiting a month. And so none of this makes any sense at all. Now, I don't like a lot of the rhetoric that came out of the last couple of days. I thought the first day, which was the shortest, was the best day for the White House. You know, they knocked down a number of arguments, and I thought some of them were embarrassing for the House managers. You know, the House managers kept on saying that the president never complained about corruption in any other country, and that also was demolished. I mean, they gave plenty of examples where the president has held back aid to other countries based expressly on his concerns about corruption or sharing the cost with allies. And that's another sort of blunder. I think the House managers also blundered with some of their rhetoric. Both Schiff and Nadler got pushback on saying that the Republican senators were part of a cover-up and suggesting that they were afraid that they would have their heads put on pikes. Well, two of the four senators that they were trying to secure for witnesses immediately objected. Susan Collins sent a note to the Chief Justice, and he admonished both sides. And those are the types of blunders you really can't afford. You know, in law school, one of the things that you tell students is that you can insult on occasion your opposing counsel, the defendant, maybe even the judge, but you can never insult the jury if you really want a verdict. And I'm not convinced that either side is working that hard for a bipartisan verdict. It seems to me that this is a strategy that is not geared towards changing minds.
So what is the strategy geared for then? It sounds like the strategy is geared for November 2020.
Well, I think it may be. And on this, I think Kate and I agree. I think the election is irrelevant. There's never a good time to impeach a president. You know, with Andrew Johnson, the vote on the articles was suspended. They voted on the first article, and then they took a break. They took a break because they went to the Republican convention to pick the next candidate for president. So the fact that these occur during political periods is not particularly new. But I think both sides can be criticized. You know, Democratic senators talk often about the need for the Republican colleagues to show bipartisanship. But they don't show much bipartisanship. I mean, Article 2 is deeply flawed. I haven't seen many Democratic senators say, you know what, I might vote against that. So I think both sides are really floating on a sea of hypocrisy.
Kate Shaw, do you want to respond to that?
You know, I think that both sides do seem fairly dug into their partisan positions. But that's, of course, not new when it comes to impeachment. I mean, you have had historically, you've had a couple of defections in favor of acquittal. But I'm not sure in either Clinton or the Johnson cases you ever had members of the president's party voting to convict. And so this would be actually consistent with those if, in fact, it's a party line, a vote on conviction. I mean, I think the key questions are antecedent to the ultimate conviction question because, you know, in the Clinton case, for example, there was a kind of bipartisan agreement, not a kind of bipartisan, a truly bipartisan agreement around things like the trial process, which resulted in, you know, these depositions being played as opposed to live witnesses coming in. You had some defections from the president's party in terms of voting to dismiss the articles at an early stage of the proceedings. And so actually, I think that if what we saw on the very first day when there were votes about whether to call witnesses at the outset, if we see this kind of real hardening into partisan camps around the witness votes that I think we're likely to have on Friday of this week, if that happens, then I think you really do have pretty definitive evidence that we are seeing play, you know, in the votes in the Senate, the kind of hyperpolarization of the moment reflected even more than in the already quite partisan presidential impeachments of our history.
Well, let's just go to a caller here while we can. Let's go to Michelle, who's calling from Lockport, New York. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I did find two arguments. I listened yesterday to the president's defense team, particularly compelling, and I would like the experts to comment on it if they would. The Founding Fathers' concern that impeachment would be used as a political weapon, and they cited two examples of kind of the similar things going on during the Obama administration, where President Obama withheld documents and did not provide information in what has become known as Fast and Furious, and the clip of Vice President Biden seemingly bragging about not providing aid to Ukraine until they fired the prosecutor that the Obama administration wanted fired. But we had a Democrat majority in the House, I believe, at that time, so there was no talk of impeachment. Now we have the opposing party majority in the House, so a president does seemingly the exact same things that the prior administration did, and everybody jumps all over it, and he must be impeached. So I just found those two arguments to stand out, and I wondered how the experts felt about those.
Yeah, and so, Michelle, I'll turn it back to our professors here in just a second. But about the, you know, the withholding of aid to Ukraine, I mean, isn't the question of in whose interest, right? Because I think if it's done in the interest of the United States as a whole, that's a different thing than what John Bolton is saying now, reportedly saying in his book that he believes there's he has firsthand information, hearing it from the president himself, that the president wanted to withhold the aid in exchange for an investigation into Joe Biden for political purposes. Isn't that the kind of core question here?
I understand that, but the prosecutor, I believe, that Vice President Biden wanted fired was going to investigate the Bidens or was currently actively investigating.
He was the issue is he was not investigating them enough. That's, I think, what the concern the United States had at the time.
I had heard from several sources that it was the opposite concern, okay, that they did not want to be a part of a corruption investigation. So I just feel that we have two examples of something that's so very similar to what President Trump is being impeached or has been impeached for. And, you know, there was no talk of impeachment back then, especially during Fast and Furious. But, again, the political party that had the majority in the House was the same party as that of the presidency. So my concern is that moving forward, anytime we have opposing majority in the House and the political party to which the president belongs, there's this risk that impeachment is going to come up as perhaps a political weapon. And I just wondered how the experts feel about that.
Well, let me turn it right back to them. So, Michelle, thank you so much for that call. I mean, Jonathan Turley, this is something that the president's defense team was saying vociferously yesterday, that we, you know, in Ken Starr's language, we've entered the age of impeachment.
Well, I agree with Michelle that they landed both those punches. The fast and furious issue, something I addressed in my testimony in the House Judiciary, you know, the Obama administration adopted as extreme a position as the Trump administration. And by the way, the Trump administration's position on the fact that these subpoenas were invalid is identical to the position of previous administrations. They were not arguing anything that was just, you know, created for this administration. But in Fast and Furious, the judge not only turned down President Obama's sweeping claim of executive authority, but she said that it was not, she would not be able to maintain that argument within our very system of separation of power. She said it would defeat the very basis of our constitutional system, very strong language. So this is not the first administration to make these arguments. With regard to Hunter Biden, I think they did land the punches. I've said for weeks that Hunter Biden's a relevant witness. I mean, he's not relevant to making the prosecution's case. He's a defense witness. You know, it's under the federal rules. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I would expect to get Hunter Biden because he has relevant information to the theory of the defense. That is, if the president is maintaining, as he is, that he raised this issue out of a concern for corruption, then the Hunter Biden contract and Hunter Biden himself is relevant. And the Democrats have to be very careful. When they cross that Rubicon for witnesses, they may find Hunter Biden waiting on the other side.
Well, Kate, I'll give you a chance to respond when we come back from a quick break. We're talking with two legal scholars about their view of the president's defense as it's currently being laid out in the United States Senate. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with a pair of legal scholars, and they're giving us their analysis of the president's defense as it's unfolding in the United States Senate in the impeachment trial against President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Kate Shaw. She's a law professor at Cardozo Law at Yeshiva University. She's with us from New York. Jonathan Turley also joins us. He's a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. And Kate and Jonathan, last week we spoke with a pair of legal scholars when the House managers were giving their arguments. One of those legal scholars was Lawrence Tribe from Harvard University, and he sort of described what the House managers were doing as painting a picture. And if there were any holes in the picture, any holes in their argument, it's because the White House, as we've discussed, hadn't given over requested documents or allowed witnesses to testify during the House's inquiry. And then Lawrence Tribe said, following the House manager's arguments regarding those potential gaps, it's now up to the president's defense team. And here's more of what he said.
The burden now falls to the president's team to fill in the gaps, right. And therefore they're the ones who ought to be asking for Bolton's and Mulvaney's testimony.
So that was Larry Tribe last week. And of course, in the interim, we've had these reported revelations from John Bolton's book about Bolton saying that the president indeed did want to withhold that $400 million from Ukraine in exchange for a an investigation into Vice President Joe Biden. And we also have reports now that that John Bolton was also concerned that the president might be handing out favors for autocratic leaders, according to his book. So in the wake of all that, here's Senator Mitt Romney reacting to this news. He told reporters that he wants to hear more from John Bolton in the Senate impeachment trial.
I can't begin to tell you how John Bolton's testimony would ultimately play on a final decision, but it's relevant, and therefore I'd like to hear it. What impact that might have would be dependent upon all the facts associated with it. We'd hear from, obviously, prosecution and defense as to what was relevant and what was said and how that might influence our final vote. But I can't begin to tell you how that would be resolved. I've indicated, I see myself as a senator juror. And in that capacity, I will maintain impartiality to the extent I can.
So, Kate Shaw, before the break, Jonathan Turley was talking about how Democrats might want to tread lightly because if they cross this witness Rubicon, they might find Hunter Biden on the other side. Well, what's your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, and if I could a little bit respond to the last caller, Magna.
Sure.
I do think that, first, on the Fast and Furious issue, it's of course right that every White House has asserted prerogatives to keep some documents from disclosure, whether to an independent counsel or to Congress. But tens of thousands of documents were produced in Fast and Furious. The litigation was over a subset of documents that the White House continued to claim privilege over. And I think we'd be in a different place if the Trump White House had given some documents, access to maybe some witnesses and a back and forth that ensued. So I do think that those circumstances are different. But to the second part of our question and to your question about Hunter Biden, I think that whether or not the White House has successfully made out the case that there was some legitimate concern about corruption involving Hunter Biden, it feels like there's this deep question, which is that, how could it ever be appropriate for the president to, in secret, solicit the assistance of a foreign government in investigating the conduct of a U.S. citizen, right? We have this vast law enforcement apparatus, and if there were any genuine concern about this sort of corruption, the Justice Department and the State Department are the right institutions to go to, and in a transparent way. I mean, I suppose you don't need to do a press conference if you want some investigation, but certainly not this kind of phone call with a foreign leader. So it just feels like that is a gaping hole. Even if you do take the White House at its word that there were these genuine corruption concerns animating the president, that just seems like, sort of definitionally an improper and potentially abusive way to proceed in the face of even say they were genuine concerns. Mm.
Now, Jonathan Turley, actually, there's something that Kate has said a couple of times in the course of this conversation that I just want to turn directly to you. And I'm not sure I have yet. So let me just do that. I mean, Kate has made the point multiple times that it's the totality of the lack of cooperation from the White House in the course of the House's investigation, documents and witnesses, that is demonstrably different than impeachment moments of the past. Now, first of all, do you agree with that analysis? And second of all, if you do, doesn't that in and of itself provide kind of a concerning precedent for a branch of government's complete unwillingness to cooperate at all with a co-equal branch?
Well, first of all, I did not agree with the position of the White House in refusing to turn over any of these documents. But I think it is fair to raise the White House perspective. They're pointing out that no impeachment in history has proceeded without the authority to issue subpoenas. That is their objection on the face of this, and it is an objection that is, I think, good faith, is that there was no underlying authority given to this committee to issue these subpoenas. And the reason why it was such a blanket and broad refusal is because they were challenging that critical factor not being present. And also what they've said is that the House really didn't engage in much of a give and take. In the past, you've had other administrations refuse witnesses and documents, and there's been negotiations. In some cases, there's been litigation. Most occasions, there's been a resolution. In this case, the House refused to respond to that in the same way that the White House has drawn a line in the sand. Ideally, this could have gone to the courts. But of course, this all was rushed forward, and they decided to go forward on this incomplete record. With regard to Hunter Biden, I would simply respond that it's not enough to simply say this is an inferential impeachment and we'll just decide all inferences against the president. And my co-witnesses at the hearing admitted that this was largely an inferential case because they didn't go after these witnesses with direct evidence. But you can't just simply say, I'm just going to resolve all inferences against the president. He has a defense. There were stories before that call that highlighted Hunter Biden and the corruption allegations in Ukraine. That contract was ongoing in 2019. It was going on during the Trump administration. And so I have said I thought it was inappropriate for him to raise the Bidens. Mm. But just as I don't believe that Alan Dershowitz is right, that indictable is synonymous with impeachable, I also don't think objectionable is synonymous with impeachable. I don't think this comes close to what we're looking for the removal of a president.
Kate, do you have a response to that?
Well, so, I think that, and this is maybe a segue into the kind of John Bolton question, which is that this inferential and circumstantial case that the House has largely built, and I think that there's plenty of direct evidence, but of course it's right that the people who were closest to the president were prevented from giving their direct accounts. And so that is a gap. And in the last 72 hours or so, we know that there is someone who is, in the figure of John Bolton, who claims to have this firsthand information about the president explicitly linking this military aid to investigations into the Bidens and potentially other Democrats. That's not quite explained in the New York Times reporting, but there is a suggestion that maybe there were more investigations. Maybe it's just the server and the Clintons and then Burisma and the Bidens, but it's just not totally clear. One way or another, there is a fuller picture that could emerge if John Bolton were permitted to tell a public story, in particular in the context of Senate testimony. And so, the question of sort of burden, the clip that you played from Professor Tribe from last week, I'm not sure who's, I don't think we're a little bit, it's all a little uncharted who bears what burden here. Is it the case that the burden shifts to the White House to fill the gaps? I'm not sure that's right. But I also don't think it's right that the House managers have a criminal burden, right? That's a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But either way, there are gaps in both accounts. And it would seem like from the perspective of the public having a fuller account of what transpired and the senators being able to make an informed judgment, everyone should want more information to come forward.
Yeah. Let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question really is, the Republican argument is no do-overs. And in their arguments, they say the impeachment inquiry itself was a sham and that, they weren't allowed president wasn't allowed due process. But just, in of itself, it seems that the impeachment inquiry is just the investigation into whether or not they can bring articles of impeachment to the Senate. So how can these Republican lawmakers say no do-overs when part of a trial is to actually cross-examine the witness and allow the president's team to cross-examine the witnesses that were, cross-examined or talked to during an investigation? So where is the argument there that this is a do-over somehow because they didn't subpoena people during an investigation? Mm-hmm. They gathered enough information that they felt it was, feasible to send it to the Senate.
Yeah. Well, so Matt, thank you for your call. And I'll turn to Jonathan Turley for a response to that. What do you think?
Well, I think Matt raises a good point. But the perspective of the senators is that they're creating precedent of another kind. I warned the House Judiciary that this was the thinnest record of any impeachment in history. It is ridiculous how thin this record is. And more importantly, what could have been in the record? One of the members said, does this look thin waving around a notebook? Well, if you were to try to wave around the record in Clinton, you'd need an 18-wheeler. I mean, they needed two vans to convey just that part of the record. That's the difference in how slim this record is. Now, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't call witnesses. In fact, a while back, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post suggesting that, in my view, senators have a legitimate concern that if they let this go forward and let the House and call witnesses that the House should have called as part of its investigation, it creates bad precedent. What I suggested is that what they should do is they should shoot Article 2. As the penalty for what the House did. And the House made a mistake. This is a bad way to go about impeaching a president. But then I think they should allow witnesses on Article 1. And in that way, they convey the view of the Senate that this is not acceptable. But they also accept, as Matt noted, that they have a separate obligation, regardless of what the House did wrong.
Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I mean, obviously everything that both of you have said we could dig into individually for an hour, but we're down to 5 minutes, and I just want to play a couple of more moments from what we heard the president's defense team yesterday. So here, first of all, is White House counsel Pat Cipollone sort of talking about how he might see impeachment proceedings.
I would maybe put it differently. I would maybe call it the golden rule of impeachment. For the Democrats, the golden rule could be do unto Republicans as you would have them do unto Democrats. And hopefully we will never be in another position in this country where we have another impeachment, but vice versa for that rule.
White House counsel Pat Cipollone in 2020, wondering if in his mind he invoked 1998 at all. Here's Ken Starr, who back in the late 90s was the independent counsel who investigated President Bill Clinton. And here's what he said.
Like war, impeachment is hell. Or at least presidential impeachment is hell. Those of us who lived through the Clinton impeachment, including members of this body, full well understand that a presidential impeachment is tantamount to domestic war, albeit thankfully protected by our beloved First Amendment, a war of words and a war of ideas. But it's filled with acrimony and it divides the country like nothing else.
Ken Starr in the Senate yesterday, he did give a nod there to the Clinton impeachment, which he was thoroughly bound up in. But Kate and Jonathan, I wanted to play those two clips because I think for a lot of citizens watching this process over the past many months, anyone with any kind of historical memory is hearing political echoes from the late 90s, and it's kind of driving us crazy. I mean, there's little doubt as to why there's such little trust amongst the American people in political proceedings that happen in Washington. So Kate, let me just start with you. For the sanity check question here, when we're talking about impeachment right now and you know, quote unquote, the success of impeachment, honestly, what does that really mean?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So I think there are people right now who are sort of saying there's a lot of very serious evidence of presidential misconduct, and yet the president is almost sure to be acquitted. And all that means is that – or one of the things it means is that the impeachment process is not up to the task of this hyper-polarized moment in which party loyalty sort of transcends everything. Institutional loyalty, you know, to say Congress, you know, loyalty to constitutional expectations or oaths or anything else. So, you know, I guess it a little bit depends on what we think it means for impeachment to work, right? Does it only work if it is possible under some circumstances for 67 senators to vote to convict and remove a president? I mean, that's a very high bar to get to. And in some ways, as both Cipollone and Starr made their arguments yesterday, that is what I kept thinking. They sort of said it is dangerous for impeachment to be normalized, and they suggested that it's important that the Senate send a message that that's not going to happen here and that will somehow head off future impeachments. And it also felt like, you know, maybe there's like a veiled suggestion embedded in some of the comments that, you know, the next Democratic president is sure to be impeached, and maybe there will just be a normalization of impeachment. Maybe it's going to be the case that in the same way in parliamentary systems, there are these routine no confidence votes against a prime minister. You know, impeachment in the House will come to be sort of routinized. And that, I think, is actually could be quite dangerous in that it means you could not actually – impeachment loses its meaning and couldn't be deployed and effectively used to remove a president who profoundly violates an oath of office and, say, endangers the country.
Well, Jonathan Turley, we've got about 30 seconds left, and I'm wondering if you have an answer to that question too.
Well, I think there's a reason why the soap operas on TV are pulling twice the audience of the impeachment trial. And as shocking as this may be, it's because the drama seems more real. A lot of viewers view the impeachment trial as baked in on both sides. Both these senators are saying things that oppose to what they've said before. And so they're switching over to the young and the restless because it seems more authentic, and that's an indictment of everyone.
Then, of course, there's the question that if not impeachment, what tools do we have in the Constitution? Perhaps elections are the only remaining one. But Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kate Shaw, law professor at Cardozo Law at Yeshiva University, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.